Hello, it's great to have you with me. I'm Kim Clyden, former ABC radio presenter and children's book author, creating a community of people who care about children. How do we nurture creative, connected, resilient, emotionally intelligent, and empowered children? And they say it takes a village, or what we might call today a community. So if you're feeling overwhelmed by the responsibility, you're not alone. I believe we can change the narrative for our children, but to do that, we need to change our story. I wasn't sure what to expect, but 2026 is already shaping up to be full of possibilities and opportunities. This episode showcases innovation and the power of asking one simple question. Why? Brent Beecham is a former accountant who swapped spreadsheets for sustainability and co-founded Second Squeeze, a business that's changing the way we think about food waste. Worldwide, around a third of all food produced is wasted, often due to oversupply or poor manufacturing practices. Brent saw an opportunity not just to reduce waste, but to reimagine value. With his co-founder Nick, they've partnered with Australian farmers and some of the country's most recognisable food brands. The business rescues surplus and discarded fruit and bread products, transforming them into syrups, powders, and liqueurs with entirely new lives. What began just 3 years ago as an idea originally was called Waste Transition Focused, or WTF. It led to their first product, a liqueur made from surplus raisin toast. Today, the business is breathing new life into foods that would otherwise end up in landfill. Brent, I've come to understand that innovation like this never happens in isolation. What kind of upbringing did you have that fostered this sense of curiosity and ingenuity?
Well, probably just a critical thinker from a young age. I remember I've got a 3 and a 4 year old now, so it's interesting to be able to look through the lens of them realizing that they're half your DNA, and you start to see the similarities. And looking back now, I've realized that I was very curious. I was extremely keen to understand things, but I was scared to ask my parents questions, and I don't know why. So I spent a lot of time internalizing things and figuring it out for myself, which at the time didn't really recognize the fact that there was probably a good bunch of skills to be able to go through life critically thinking and assessing everything along the way. Grew up in a beachside suburb in southern Sydney, had a love of the ocean, of the environment and those types of things. And so I suppose as I got older, I was looking for something where I could make a genuine difference in people's lives. And when the opportunity came up for this, to be able to tie that into the environmental aspect, which I'd always been a recycler, you know, I was the type of person who, if there was rubbish on the ground, I'd pick it up and put it in the bin and those types of things. And so I was really able to look at this and recognize the opportunity to really tackle a big problem head on. And there's a difference between a good idea and a commercially viable business. And I think that we've done a good job of reconciling them. So to be able to help and to be able to commercialize at the same time were two things that I was interested in.
I love the way you've tied environmental benefit to your innovation currently and your connection to the environment through your upbringing. So why do you think cultures like outdoor activities like surfing and being coastal or even bush in communities fosters this connection to something bigger than ourselves?
I think as humans, we're conditioned through our primary senses. And so visually, to contrast walking along a beach or people that are into the bush, you know, in particular the beach after a storm, and to see everything washed up, you're seeing these real contrasting colours. So you're seeing logs and you're seeing seaweed and you're seeing driftwood, but then at the same time you're seeing bottles and cans and all these things that are these colours that you wouldn't naturally see on the beach. And so you culminate that with, you know, growing up in southern Sydney, there was a time when Bondi, well, I grew up in Cronulla, but Bondi, Maroubra and even Cronulla, these sorts of places, they all had sewage facilities so that when it rained, all of the sewage would end up in the water, which would end up back on the beach. So you weren't able to go surfing, you know, the water was brown and all these types of things. And so you start to recognize the fact that these decisions that are being made on our behalves are directly impacting our lives and our enjoyment. And so I suppose that probably subconsciously, that's where there was a catalyst as I got older and I started to recognize that, where I was able to start to implement that into the conscious and start to say, okay, well, can I make a difference?
Well, you are now making a difference. I see behind you on your banner that you've been a winner of the World Beverage Innovation Awards for 2025. That's a great accolade. So congratulations on that for Best CSR Sustainability Initiative. I'm now thinking how this all transferred. How does one innovate a process and then source the types of materials you need to create the products you're now creating?
Really good question. So my business partner is a third generation fruiterer. The business came about with them trying to identify ways which they could reduce their waste, because they make cold pressed juices and acai and those types of things. So cold pressed juices are delicious, but basically you're taking all the fiber and everything out with the exception of just the juice. So you're left with an awful lot of pulp in the end across things like carrot, watermelon, Davidson plum, some really things that are really yummy to eat. And once you draw that juice out, there's an awful lot left over. So from a commercial perspective, if you're buying a whole watermelon and you're left with the skin and you're left with the pulp at the end, you've spent a lot of money to take only a small part of it from it. So how do you monetize it? In the, I suppose, prior to the wave of sustainability, it wasn't necessarily an opportunity. You could ground down the carrot, you could turn it into a powder, but the price that it was going to cost to do that wasn't feasible for a business to take it on and substitute one of their inputs. Whereas now we're seeing the way that consumers are demanding sustainability, they're willing to pay a premium for it, and brands that are actually doing these things are starting to carve out their own place in those supply chains. Whereas, like I said before, it wasn't possible. So Mike and Doug had access to this. So we've made it, and there's a really good video on our website where Davidson plum, which they were using for juice, we've been able to take and be able to create a syrup out of this Davidson plum that was already pressed. And so it's basically just the skin and the tiny little bit of fruit that's left on the inside of the skin. So at the end of it, we're left with this absolutely delicious syrup of something that would have ended up in landfill. But then on the flip side, we can now take it one step further and we can dry it and we can powder it. So from a commercial standpoint, a business that was previously using Davidson plum powder at about $500 a kilo, because to get 1 kilo of Davidson plum powder, you need 10 kilos of Davidson plum. So it's that 10 to 1 ratio. So it's an awful lot of resources and an awful lot of money that goes into something which shrinks down to a small amount. So any sort of business that was using dried Davidson plum in their food products, and we've got one that does it in their granola, they were spending an absolute fortune on this dried Davidson plum. We were able to substitute it in with our syrup, which has given them a flavor profile, which is very similar. But the outcome for them is they're a huge reduction in cost of sales. So on one hand, we've reconciled this waste problem with the commercial viability of it. And just to scale that out and to directly answer your question, through my business partner's connections through these fruiters, we were able to get our hands on stuff that typically would have just been ground back into the earth and used as compost. So the O Lemonade, which is a really cool story, and ask about that in a second, I'll tell you about it, which is what we won the awards for. We work directly with OzHarvest. So everybody knows who OzHarvest is. OzHarvest has created OzHarvest Ventures, which is their corporate entity, which is working to negate the necessity for donations. And so they're working on creating consumer products in the food and beverage space that they're able to start to commercialize their brand and leverage that to be able to bring dollars in. So every can of that's sold, if you can maybe see there, is one meal for a homeless person. And at the same time, there's a donation that goes back to their corporate entity. So for us to be able to grow at the same time, OzHarvest was a fantastic partner, because OzHarvest is getting phone calls left and right for every type of food you can think of. Hey, can you take this? Hey, can you take that? And fresh produce, which was something that they would love to take, unfortunately, they can't, because logistically, the time it's going to take to get it from point A to point B, to be able to have it in cold storage, to be able to get someone to turn it into something, and then to be able to push it out to homeless people, is a really difficult task. And at the same time, maintaining HACCP protocols and those types of things. So logistically, there was only so many things that they could do with this fresh produce. And at the time, there wasn't anything they could do. So we took the lemons. The lemon was basically our first proof of concept. And we took lemons and we made lemonade. We've started to branch out from there now. So there's a lemon ginger, and a lemon strawberry. So all of these are foodstuffs that would have been ended up back in landfill, ground back into the ground, which for whatever reason wasn't able to be sold commercially, and we're able to turn these things into delicious products. So having access to these was probably pivotal for the success of the business and for us to be able to scale it. And now we're now working with our first two commercial partners to work around what a license agreement is for them to be able to use our processes and systems actually on site. Because from a sustainability perspective, for them to be able to get that fresh produce from their farm over to us to make the syrup and to push it out, there's an awful lot of resources that are going into that, from logistics, procurement, and all those types of things, which kind of, negates the impact that we're able to make if we're able to do it on their site and they're able to do it there, and then actually turn it into a syrup and then move it out from there. And as you're probably aware, there's no shortage of primary producers in Australia who are ploughing quality produce into the ground because of the ridiculous standards and visual appeal that the certain monopoly, and I'll use the word monopoly because they're both owned by the same people, and how we've been preconditioned now as consumers for things to need to be visually perfect. So, you know, you see those ads and the oranges, the apples, everything's uniform, everything's beautiful, when in reality, that just isn't life. I've got 4 tons of lemons out there at the moment that are the ugliest looking lemons that you could ever see, and no shop would ever sell them. But I can tell you right now, once I make the syrup out of it, they're going to be delicious and nobody's ever going to know. And that's the unfortunate world we live in. I shop at a farmer's market on the weekend. So things that are ugly and battered and bruised to me don't have that same impact. But unfortunately, consumers as a whole have been conditioned to think that it must look perfect on the outside for it to be delicious on the inside, when unfortunately that isn't the reality.
I have spoken with many innovators and inventors over my years, and I'm wondering, as someone who's disrupted a waste supply, what challenges you've faced in relation to regulation, legislation, or even just setting up and distributing?
What we've found, and personally from experience now, is that those headwinds that you talk about, if you've got a good product that's commercially viable, the tailwinds that you will find in this space will be unbelievable. The support and the generosity of time and resources from businesses all the way through to, I come back to Goodman Fielder, who have been absolutely amazing. That's a company that turns over a huge amount of money, and the support that they've given us to be able to get that product into something that's on the shelf now in BWS and Dan Murphy's, shameless plug again. The problems that a conventional business will have, you will not have if you've got something that's going to make a genuine difference. And for anybody who's out there having a think about potentially dipping their toes into the sustainability space, figure out who the businesses and the organizations, the non-for-profits, the arms of government, where you can really start to benefit and help them in a win-win situation, and they will push you forward. The biggest hurdle we've had along that supply chain has been the education piece to manufacturers. Because that's the, in essence, just like Coke, just like Pepsi, our business isn't creating a can, it's creating the syrup. It's creating the magic sauce that goes into it. So that syrup market is a commodity market that that is worth billions globally. So you can split it out into chocolate, into maple syrup, and then into fruit syrups. So for the opportunity, say, in contrast to, so OzHarvest has made a strawberry lemonade, which would probably be a direct competitor to, say, Fanta. In contrast, Fanta, you know, Coca-Cola, fantastic business, been around for a long time, but there's artificial colors in it, there's preservatives, there's artificial flavors, and there's all those types of things. And so really trying to communicate the value proposition to some of these big manufacturers to start to have a look at the way that they're making things at the moment, and start to question the status quo, and be able to really feed back that valuable data around what consumers are looking at. Because, I mean, in America at the moment, you're seeing RFK Jr., and he's got a huge push on basically trying to get rid of artificial colors and artificial flavors and preservatives and those types of things in confectionery and in sodas and all those types of things. And so we're a little bit behind the eight ball in Australia at the moment. So probably I'd say that our biggest issue has been opening up the doors to some of these bigger manufacturers and saying, hey, we've got something here that's healthier, that's sustainable, that we can compete at a price of what you're buying all those artificial things for. Hey, let's start having some conversations.
Well, as you mentioned, consumers have become more and more demanding, but they're also open now to understanding provenance and sustainability. So what pressure does that put on you, especially when people are also looking to reduce sugar, empty calories, and all those sorts of things in today's society?
The sugar one's interesting because I towed the same narrative as what you are now. And the reality is that you go walk into the supermarket and it's just full of sugar. Every single shelf has just got products that are just packed with sugar, whether we like it or not. So the beauty of our product is that you can use as little or as much as you want in it. So we've got a vodka soda that we've done, and we've got it down to low sugar, being under 5%. But you can put as little or as much in there, depending on how much you want of it. Sugar is a reality that's kind of been demonized. The reality of that is that it's everything in small amounts. And if you're able to do that, then you're able to enjoy these types of things without going overboard on it. And while I think big organizations and the government's pushing back on this sugar, it really comes back to the individual to be able to look at their own intake of these types of things and manage it in a way that's self-sustaining.
You mentioned that you have children. What do you think they're taking away from your entrepreneurial endeavors?
Well, they love my products. From two kids that are ironically deprived of sugar, thanks to a mother who takes a huge care in ensuring that they eat healthy things. They love the treats, but broadly for them, I think that it's made me reflect on, in a narrow sense, you start looking at it and saying, well, you know, how can we embed some sort of culture and some sort of framework where kids can start looking at this through a fresh lens and take the ideas that our generation now is working on and start to come up with bigger and better. And where I came to that, and I preempted this, and where I came to is that I think that it's probably, as opposed to teaching them these narrow skills of looking broadly at the problem of critical thinking, which, you know, the name of your podcast is perfect. And so, you know, and how can we actually start to really make a difference? And I think it probably comes back to that. The people that got us into these problems, they're not going to get us out of it. They're not, and it's going to take a fresh perspective. When I went to school and when you went to school, the teachers sat up the front and they went, ho, well, you need to learn how to do addition and subtraction because you're not going to walk around with a calculator in your pocket. Well, here those same people are now walking around with not only a calculator in their pocket, walking around with a faster computer than they ever could have imagined. Yet our education system is still set up to teach facts. Why are we teaching facts when these facts are available readily on the internet through the postgraduate programs? It's not about filling your head with information. It's about finding ways to go and find that information and to dissect it in terms of relevance. And so I think that there of what I've really been trying to teach my kids is that I look at the world and I say that I don't think it's getting better. I think that it's probably getting worse. I mean, people are willing to argue, but if we look at the stats and if we look at, you know, our consumer spending, you know, discretionary income, if we look at, you know, the price of petrol, our education system, our healthcare system, they're in decline. And that's my observation. And I think that from a very young age, the way that I've been looking to probably change the mindset of my children is to look at things critically and to teach them to be able to find answers that resonate with them as opposed to what society says.
From someone who already told me they were afraid to ask their parents questions, and often it can be because they're busy or they haven't got time, and so you learn as a child not to bother them. How different are you making it for your children so that they can be curious and they can show up and ask questions?
I think you always try and do a little bit better job than your parents, and you can use them as a benchmark. And, you know, if you were lucky enough to know your grandparents as well and understand the dynamic and the relationship between your grandparents and your parents, and just trying to, I suppose, be the parent that I wish that I had. I think probably the big one for me, the big observation that I had as I got older and got married and started to, and, you know, this thing of love language, and it was only in the last 12 months or so that I've recognized that my love language was touch. And I recognized that I probably didn't get a lot of affection as a child. And I think that probably that there was this element of where you start to filter it. And so if you're not feeling it inside, you're not able to verbalize it, you're not able to communicate it, you're not able to act it. And so I think that ultimately, you know, there's that thing where, you know, previous generations, a father didn't necessarily hug his son. And I've really tried to break down that gender stereotype and look at it like it's their beings. My son and my daughter are both beings. They both deserve the same amount of love, the same amount of affection. And if I'm able to give that to my son, then hopefully the bits that I missed out of. And unfortunately, you know, it was that generational gap. And that's how it was. I mean, like my grandparents, well, my dad's parents, I still remember they slept in separate beds in the same room, but in separate beds. And, you know, and there was this platonic relationship, but you never saw anything more than that. And so, you know, my dad probably wanted a little bit more than that. And I observed that in my mum and dad. But I wanted a little bit more than that for my children there. And so I think it's, you know, those tiny little ones, the ones that you'll need to work on over time. But what were those really big gaps that you feel that maybe you missed out on in childhood and that would have encouraged you or fostered more love to be able to be brought out? Because ultimately, I think that's what we need. We look at society in terms of primitive or advanced on the basis of technology these days. I look around and you know, you go to these somewhat primitive cultures when you travel and you go, wow, those people are a lot more loving. Those people are a lot more caring. So if you were to say flip that and use the metric of primitive versus advanced purely on compassion, you'd start to realize that we're very primitive. You know, if I'm able to be more compassionate, to be more understanding of their needs, but also realize that, you know, they are half my DNA. And if I'm able to understand those gaps that I felt that I had and to be able to do a better job, then hopefully I can foster some difference, which enables them to be able to go out and hopefully spread some joy to the people that are around them as they grow older.
That is one of the best ways I've heard that summarised. Thank you so much for giving us your insight. Honestly, when I've travelled overseas, particularly through Egypt and Africa, those people are some of the happiest people I've ever seen, and yet their lives are so much more simple than ours. Thank you so much for giving me your time today, for sharing your story and those insights. I really appreciate it, and I hope I can revisit this story as things change for you and Second Squeeze.
Yeah, check in anytime. Love it.
Brent Beecham, co-founder of Second Squeeze, talking about how we all have a responsibility to think about the future. If you'd like to know more about Brent's company and, of course, his socials, you'll find all of those links in the show notes that accompany this episode. If you've got an idea for someone who you think could be a great guest on this show, why not reach out to me? All of my contact details are in the show notes as well, or you can simply go to my website, kimclidon.com. That's KIMKLEIDON.com. It's a pleasure being back with you this year. I look forward to more great conversations and hopefully connecting with you in 2026. Be the change you want to see in the world, just like Brent.